KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's 9:06.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Seattle Opera yesterday named the man who will replace longtime general director Spate Jenkins. We're going to meet Aidan Lang coming up later this morning. Also, political reporter Jonathan Alter on President Obama's 2012 victory. That's coming up after 10 o'clock. The head of the union that represents Seattle police officers says it's time for the Guild to cooperate with the reform process. Seattle Times reporter Steve Miletich has been covering the police reform issue for months now. He joins us. Hi.
Good morning.
What exactly did Rich O'Neill tell the membership of the Seattle Police Officers Guild?
Well, in his column in the union newspaper, The Guardian, he urged the membership to put aside the complaints that some or a lot have had about the reforms and move forward in a cooperative way.
Where? It was in his column?
Yes, he writes a monthly column in the Guild's newspaper called The Guardian, and that's where he chose to send out this message in the June issue.
Had he been vocally oppositional in the past?
Again, through The Guardian, he has questioned the credibility of the Department of Justice investigation that led to the reforms, saying that it had been proven false and lacked credibility. And although The Guardian does not purport to be representative of the Seattle Police Officers Guild's overall views and that the people who write in it are reflecting their own opinions, The Guardian has also become a pretty strong voice of opposition to the reforms. So, you know, Rich is, you know, through The Guardian, there's been a message conveyed over time that, of resistance to these changes.
Well, what brought about his change of opinion?
Well, it's hard to know for sure, but it looks like it came out of a meeting in May between Rich O'Neill, Merrick Bobb, the independent federal monitor overseeing the reforms, and the interim police chief, Jim Pugel, which was held in Chief Pugel's office. You know, I don't know exactly what was said there, but I get the impression there was some pretty candid conversation and that Mr. Bobb expressed some strong concerns about the position of the union and whether they were dug in on reforms.
Has Chief Pugel had anything public to say about the reform process?
Well, he has. He has also basically said the same thing as Rich O'Neill, but earlier, when he became interim chief a while back, he said that it was time to move forward, that the fighting was over, the best thing to do was get these things going and, you know, get the reforms in place so the department could move past them.
We're talking with Seattle Times reporter Steve Miletich. The Guild recently overwhelmingly approved its new contract. What relationship does that contract have to this reform process?
Well, I think that's another factor in all of this, that these reforms were dovetailing with contract negotiations that had gone on for months. There was an expired contract that was rolled over. So that kind of played into some of the bad feelings between the Guild and the city and the DOJ. I think once they reached a collective bargaining agreement in late April, that took that off the table, and there were also provisions of the contract that I think the Guild felt comfortable with as far as how they would be able to bargain some of the issues surrounding these reforms. Now, that contract still has to be approved by the City Council, which will take it up this summer. But I think clearly, you know, the resolution of that issue, gave Rich O'Neill an opening, you know, to offer a more conciliatory tone.
While we're on the subject of the contract, there's one sort of thing that's been floating next to contract negotiations and next to police reform, and that has to do with who actually pays Rich O'Neill's salary of more than $100,000 a year. Has that been settled?
No. It became a sticking point towards the end of the negotiations over the collective bargaining agreement. It was kind of holding up the approval. And instead of dealing with it directly at that time, they agreed to talk about it later under a reopen provision of the contract. I think the expectation is once the city council, if they do approve this, and I would think that they will, that then the city will enter in negotiations with Sergeant O'Neill to resolve this issue. The mayor at a public forum on the mayoral election said he is not in favor of continuing this arrangement. There are members of the city council who oppose this continuing this pay. So I think it's only a matter of time before it comes back to the front burner.
All right, well, let's now we'll go back to the main point of the conversation, which has to do with this police reform process. How much weight does Rich O'Neill's column in this Guardian newspaper have with the membership in terms of police reform?
Yeah, it's a large union, so I'm sure you're going to get disparate reactions, but Rich, it carries a lot of weight. He's a big personable figure in the guild. I think people do look to him for cues. So I think it's going to be significant, even if there's not, you know, even in his column, there's some indication that he's not 100% bought in, but he's bought in enough, I think, to make the membership realize that if they want to move past these reforms, the best thing to do is cooperate and not have them drag on for years.
And finally, can you give us some kind of status report as to where the reform process is?
Well, we're into just about a year from when the city agreed to these reforms as part of a settlement agreement. A monitor, Merrick Bob, was put in place late last year. He issued his first report within the last few months, in which he said there had been progress, but there still was some foot dragging. We are looking at still, you know, several years more of this kind of oversight. The question is how many years it will be. It could be as few as three. It could be as many as five. And then, if it could go beyond. And I think that what the Guild hopes here is that by cooperating, they can shorten the process.
And will the election of a new mayor, should somebody replace Mike McGinn in the fall, will that impede or accelerate the process?
Well, I think any mayor is going to bring a certain amount of personal stamp to this process. And so we could see, depending on who's elected, variations on how fast things move forward. But I really think the key thing here is that you have a federal judge, James Robart, who has ultimate oversight over this case. And I think he'll be the one, no matter who's mayor, to guide the process and make clear that he expects the city to move forward.
Steve, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Seattle Times reporter Steve Miletich has been covering the ongoing police department reform process. And as you heard, Seattle Police Officers Guild President Rich O'Neill, in a column in the union newspaper, urged membership of the Seattle Police Officers Union to put aside past opposition and cooperate with the police department reform process. This is Weekday.
It's 9:15. Looks like some changes are coming to Seattle's Neptune Theater. We'll hear about that in a minute. KUOW and Humanities Washington present Think and Drink. Join KUOW's Steve Scher for this month's conversation. Ills, Pills, and Bills. Why does American healthcare cost so much? 7 p.m. Wednesday, June 26th at Naked City Brewery. For more information, go to kuow.org/events. 55 degrees in Seattle. It's cloudy. We've got scattered showers. We're expecting rain at times through the day and an afternoon high in the mid-60s. KUOW 916. I'm Bernard Ouellet. How much do you love your job? Listen to this. A new poll suggests that 7 out of 10 workers are checked out or actively disengaged at work. Why are so many people dissatisfied at work? We're going to look into that in 15 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. When Seattle Theater Group took over the venerable Neptune Theater in Seattle's University District, the intent was to transform the old movie house into a live performance venue, and that was accomplished. Now STG has decided to turn over the Neptune on a semi-regular basis to community groups. They call this venture Nights at the Neptune, and joining me to talk about the program and the first community production are Vicki Lee. She's Director of Education and Performance Programs for Seattle Theater Group. Nice to see you.
Hi, Marcy.
And also here is Billy Anderson, who's producer of, I think it's the first Night at the Neptune, is that how I would describe
it?
It's a comedy showcase called Out and In, part of the Pride Festival, and it's happening next week. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Vicki, I want to start with you. What was the idea behind Nights at the Neptune?
The idea was to bring to the Neptune emerging artists dealing with the issues of race, social justice, youth, marginalized populations. And one of our prongs of our mission is diverse performing arts, and these projects really support that. There's 8 projects, as you said, next week till the middle of September. And all of the artists who participate get 2 free days in the Neptune, no charge. And all of the projects can be experienced free of charge by audiences.
What, they're free?
Free. Everything's free.
Free. Well, so how did you pick who was going to be a night at the Neptune?
Well, it's kind of interesting because it's unlike what we usually do. Seattle Theater Group and our programming team, we did not curate this. We put all of the applications to about a dozen community members, and they rated them and selected what they thought fit the themes that we were looking at from the Department of Neighborhoods grant, and that's how we got there. So we really are the vehicle to help it happen, but we didn't have any artistic or curatorial take on it.
You mentioned Department of Neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. This is a city-funded program?
Yes. The Department of Neighborhoods supported Seattle Theater Group. We're at no financial gain in this project. It all goes back into the project. And the themes, as I said, we wrote a grant to adhere to those themes. And we were very fortunate to be one of the few performing arts organizations selected. A lot of Department of Neighborhood grants, as you know, are, public art projects or parks or playground equipment. Mm-hmm. So I guess it really resonated with the city. And, of course, you have to defend why it's important for the community. And also the neighborhoods in Department of Neighborhoods. We're here in the University District. And as you know, there's not a lot of performing arts venues here. And we feel the Neptune is a great place to be the vehicle for this.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, the Neptune is the only non-university performing arts venue in the University District?
Yeah, that's kind of true. There's a jazz club up the way, Lucid Lounge, but that's pretty much it. We're pretty much it, and we've had programming in the Neptune. Well, in September, it'll be 2 years, and we love the venue.
Billy Anderson, how did you find out about Nights at the Neptune?
Actually, it's a fun story. Miss Rosalie Gale, who's a local staple and a comedian in Seattle, posted to a comedy board that this opportunity was available. And, like, for example, last year we had those horrible Cafe Racer shootings. Mm-hmm. And the Neptune was wonderful to allow a fundraising event to go on there. And so I was already aware of the venue and how it worked. And so I went to the Knights of the Neptune page from Rosalie Gale's suggestion and read the overall draft, and it just seemed perfect for the kind of shows that we put on regularly here in Seattle. So
what did you have to provide?
We provided basically a show plan, a program. It explained what our goal was. Like she had mentioned, one of the things that spoke to me was underserved populations and social justice issues. So we explained how our show would cover that, and then how each performer that's on the show has dealt with something like that, has a connection. Most of the people that we have on the show have produced shows, have handled queer issues in their lives, and so it fit the theme, and their individual acts fit the theme. So we were just explaining both of those things.
So explain maybe a little bit more. This is a comedy show, but it's gay and lesbian and bi and transgender performers?
Mm-hmm. Queer and queer affiliated.
Is that the official term?
That's how I've been told. You
okay.
Know. Growing up in the South, they don't teach us those kinds of things. So, but yeah, it's queer and queer affiliated. And so there's 2 non-queer performers on the show, Mr. Emmett Montgomery, who's a local producer, and actually he produces in a gay venue, CC Addles, on Tuesdays. And there's also Derek Sheen, who's a hometown guy. He recently released a CD, And he tackles a lot of queer and queer issues. He's definitely an ally.
Is this, I know that Gay Pride Festival comes up not this weekend, but the weekend after. Mm-hmm. So is this somehow officially affiliated with Pride Festival?
It is not officially affiliated. There's a program you go through to get officially affiliated. And being that this is the first one of these we've done, they're definitely supportive. And a lot of the venues and people associated with it are very supportive. Gay City, our official sponsor, has been very supportive in getting the word out. But it is not an official Pride Week show.
Where would you have produced Out and In if you weren't doing this at the Neptune?
Well, Nick Sahoya, who's my co-producer on the show, has produced several. He produces a show called Mo Wave, which is a queer and queer allied show. He is working with Gay City. They're trying to put on some shows, and they're going to be building their own places to do that. But we've done it at Chop Suey, which is a venue here in Seattle. He's done stuff there. I mean, the Seattle comedy scene will produce in any stage that'll allow us on.
I have to say that the Neptune's a little bit bigger than Chop Suey, which is a club on Capitol Hill. I'm not sure how many seats in the Neptune or how many standing places.
Yeah, the capacity is 850. A lot of these projects will be more of a cabaret setting, so a little bit fewer than that. But it can feel very intimate when you're on the floor with cabarets. So,
this is free for you guys. So what does that mean for an organization like yours or a semi-organization like yours?
Well, looking at it, I mean, definitely the way we were told is the goal was to fill 500 seats for us to get the word out and to really take advantage of the program as it was given to us. And so it can be an intimidating thing when you're going from the Chop Suey to that. One thing is they did back us. They've given us full marketing support. They printed out a lot of flyers for us to go. We printed a lot. We've been hitting the streets, talking with people, going to the individual clubs. And so it's been a project. And I wouldn't say it's been easy, but it's for a subject matter that it's pretty close to my heart. And we're also supporting the message of Gay City, which, they give free screenings to at-risk and queer people in the city. And I believe in that. And so it's been worth a lot of the work.
What's been challenging for you about this?
It's been a lot of time. I mean, you have to hit the show. Like, I don't necessarily have the money to be able to pump into this. And that's not what the show's about. It's about they don't want us to dump money into advertising ourselves. So it's been a lot of me hitting the streets, postering with Nick, talking with people, handing out flyers, just one-on-one and getting the word out.
And that's one of the reasons Seattle Theater Group got behind that. We have three venues, and we really wanted to help emerging artists and emerging organizations with marketing and production help to kind of, bring everyone along there. The other thing I was going to say is that it's somewhat of a collective. The eight projects are all very diverse, but we had a meeting a couple of days ago, and, there was a lot of love in the room, and we'll help you if you help me, and, a lot of social media contacts. So I think it's a bringing together of a lot of diverse emerging artists in the community who wouldn't regularly cross paths.
You just handed me the list, so I can actually just touch on these are all over the place.
They are all over the place, and we have comedy, we have film, we have theater, we have dance, we have Working for Peace. One of the projects, Ward of State, is a music project and is a partnership with Treehouse, who serves foster youth and involves those issues.
What does this do for you guys at Seattle Theater Group? I think most people know you as you run the Neptune, mm-hmm. but people think of the big downtown theaters.
Right.
You're bringing in big name acts. Right. You've got big dance names,
right.
Big theater names. This is a little bit different.
We're big, but we're also small and
okay,
on the
Vicky.
Street. part of our mission is to present diverse performing arts. And we really do have an investment in local artists. And sometimes it's a little quieter what we do. We have a big investment in young artist programs, and we're growing our partnerships with local artists. And I don't know, out of this Nights at the Neptune, something else may develop for next year. One of the partnerships we're just starting with is Balagon Theater, which is a small theater, and we have a whole season of work with them at the Moore next year. So it's our big stuff is the touring, artists and mm-hmm. national and international artists, but it's very important to keep that lifeblood of local artists going as well.
You mentioned Balagon Theater. Since I have you here, I have to ask, partnership seemed to be the new watchword with the nonprofit arts organizations in town. Is that a matter of sort of survival?
It is a watchword and sometimes a buzzword that looks good on things. And are you really doing it? We do several kinds of partnerships. Some of them are marketing partnerships. Some of them are creative partnerships. But we feel when it happens, you're digging deeper in the community, you're reaching more people, and it makes us stronger. Balagon is just one. A little later today, we're going over to the Seattle Rep because we're partnering with them on Peter Brook's production of The Suit. So it's really, as our mission is diverse performing arts, our mission is also partnerships. It's really important to our survival, I think.
Vicki Lee is the Director of Education and Performance Programs for Seattle Theater Group, and one big education program coming up later is Dance This.
Yeah, here we go, 15th anniversary.
This summer, so that's always a wild time. Billy Anderson is co-producer, I guess you are, of The First Night at the Neptune, which is this coming Tuesday, June 25th. It's a comedy showcase, out and in, and it's free to everybody, free to the public, free to everybody.
Free and headlined by Solomon Giorgio, a local boy we flew back in from L.A., so we're excited to have him here.
And it starts at 8 o'clock. Thank you both for coming
Thanks,
in
Marcy.
Today.
Thank you.
This is Weekday on KUOW. From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. A new Gallup poll out suggests that 7 out of every 10 American workers hates their job, or at least checked out at work. And why is that? Is there anything that would plug workers back in? Sandeep Krishnamurti is Dean of the University of Washington Bothell School of Business, and he's here in the studio with me. Thanks for coming in. I'm going to have you move a little closer to the microphone. Dean, the poll listed 3 types of workers. They called them actively engaged, actively disengaged, i.e. people who hate their job, and then sort of the great lump in middle, those of us who really don't care one way or the other. Is this a familiar division to you?
Yeah, so good morning. I'm a big fan.
Well, thank you.
So very nice to see you. Yeah, you know, I think there's something new going on here. I mean, if you go back and if you look at the place of work in our society, there have always been jobs that people have not enjoyed. You know, the so-called dirty jobs, the non-glamorous jobs, you know, and so on. And what was stunning to me was the 7 out of 10.
I think that's a pretty big percentage.
Yeah, I think that is symptomatic of a larger issue. And then I think looked at what exactly they did, and I don't think the data itself tell us, you know, the causes for this. I think this is sort of just the first indication of some sort of a larger problem that we might be facing at a societal level.
So what larger problem is that?
So I have a few hypotheses for you today that we can explore jointly. The first thing is, you know, I think that there are some segments of society where there is some sort of a renegotiation going on in terms of the place of that sector itself in society. And higher education is a great example, you know. And, you know, I think of my wonderful staff. You know, they're so vested in and caring in about the welfare of the students. And yet we have a situation where you have the state, you know, not helping us give high performers raises for a long period of time over several years. So this is just a symptom of many sectors in the economy where problems like this are going on. And another issue has to do with immigration. You have a lot of technology workers there are issues with job mobility, so they're stuck in a job. And even though they have several ideas, they don't know how to, you know, change, or the law does not permit them to change to a completely different job. And you say, okay, these are issues. You know, some sectors, there are significant issues going on, you know, and, you know, some of them are regulatory in nature, some of them are financial in nature, and so on. And extending that to the for-profit sector, the Microsofts of the world, you know, I think there we have a situation where, and Microsoft is sort of a perfect exemplar of, you know, some of these, you know, trends that we're observing, in my view. I mean, in the early days, and I'm talking about the first decade in which Microsoft was founded, it used to be the case that you came in, you worked really hard, and you got stock options. Mm-hmm. That meant something,
right?
You know, and the company was a juggernaut. It was growing. People were rewarded for, you know, their ingenuity, their creativity, and innovation. Now there is this kind of ennui, and that is essentially the sort of situation where people are saying, great, I have a job at Microsoft, but, you know, I don't see, you know, the potential for me to go much beyond where I am right now. What I do see is maybe incremental growth, and that is tied to all kinds of politics with the annual review process. So it just seems like there's this sort of stagnation, you know, across the board. And I'm sure, you know, You have similar thoughts. So.
Well, you're the expert, but I do have questions. We're talking with Sandeep Krishnamurti, who's dean of the University of Washington Bothell School of Business. I wondered how much you mentioned that your employees, who, and I am also a state employee, but there are many people who are working in a place where a lot of their fellow workers have been laid off, and so they've had to take on more of those duties without extra compensation. And also the expectation, or the sort of unsaid expectation, that you should be happy that you have a job at all.
Right. In fact, I think that was certainly a big theme last year, where I had a lot of people tell me that my job has just gone up by 20%, 25%. You know, there are two people doing this, or one and a half people doing this. Now it's just me. And I think that is something that is, again, a renegotiation. But then you get into a deeper layer, which is, why are for-profit companies doing this? You know, I know people in Microsoft, they're wonderful. They would like to have engaged employees, to use the language of the Gallup poll.
Engaged, as opposed to disengaged.
Exactly. But then you get into issues of, you know, global competition. You get into issues of, you know, how innovation, you know, can now come from any corner of the globe. And you might have, you know, an innovative product that takes away from the business of Microsoft, and it might come from Central Europe or Asia. And so what that does is, the pressures on the companies that operate in our region, many, several innovative ones, you know, are no longer local or regional. They're global in nature. And of course, this is a larger thread, but I think there has been an exacerbation of this recent times.
I understand the economic rationale, then, you know, we have to compete on a bottom line point of view. But one of the other things that the Gallup poll pointed out was that when you have a huge pool of workers that are disengaged, you're actually costing your company money, because people are coming in and giving you the bare minimum, as opposed to giving their heart and soul to the operation. It seems like you'd want people to be engaged. You'd want them to give 110%, to use that same kind of rah-rah language.
Yeah. You know, I think that also resonated with me. You know, and I think I like this idea of intrinsic motivation. And what that tells me is that you want to work in a job that is designed in such a way that it resonates with your own passions and so on. And I think, you know, extending that idea, I think we have to think more deeply about, you know, the way we organize work in cubicle land. You know, you go to company after company, and there's just this kind of vast technological landscape where a lot of people, doesn't matter what they're doing, they're pounding away on a laptop, you know, or a netbook somewhere. And what that causes is this kind of you know, isolation or alienation, where people are not talking and challenging each other. And so this also leads people to, you know, somehow, you know, work in this kind of very isolated, compartmentalized, you know, kind of space. And then they come home, and then you have all the pressures on the family now, mm-hmm. and there's not enough social interaction on that side. So are we becoming, you know, sort of an asocial or a pseudo-social society where we have the appearance of social connectedness, but in effect, there is lack of deep meaning?
Well, that brings up two things in my mind. One is yesterday we were talking about zombie films, so we're now talking about zombie workers. But but I also, I'm originally from Detroit, and I, at some point, probably in the 80s or 90s, in an effort to engage factory workers, which mm-hmm. is essentially what a lot of tech workers have become mm-hmm. just on the line, they mm-hmm. they look to Japan, they look to other ways of organizing hierarchy. Mm-hmm. To some extent, that was successful. Are there other attempts now to look at the management of our new tech society that would engage the sort of passion and soul of workers?
There are attempts, but I think the attempts are small and not, you know, as bold as I would like to see. You know, so for example, we talk a lot about leadership, you know, and what does it mean to lead in this kind of an environment? You know, is leading just sending out a blast of emails or, you know, commenting on a Facebook, you know, post or something like that? And I think, you know, really, there has to be some sort of re-architecting. And I think part of what needs to happen is, you know, satisfying this kind of social isolation through a compelling mission, through sort of a new era of transparency, where, and I think what really gets me excited are companies like Glassdoor.com. I mean, this is a company in the Bay Area. And what they do is allow employees a chance to, you know, comment freely on their culture, you know, what they think of the CEO, and so on. And then increasingly, you know, I think what people are saying is, look, there's a big, you know, gap between, you know, my thirst for understanding of why we are who we are and how we impact the society, and my little corner of the world where I'm writing code for a new, you know, feature for a technological product. So I think one thing that I see is that leaders can do more in terms of increased transparency and compelling mission.
Sandeep Krishnamurti is Dean of the UW Bothell School of Business. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Marcy.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Seattle Opera, one of the city's oldest arts organizations, has chosen Aidan Lang as its next general director. A conversation with Aidan Lang in a minute.
Being a teenager and looking for a job means learning some simple do's and don'ts, like this one.
Ha, voicemail. You know what to do. Stupid.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Sometimes the biggest problem is figuring out when not to act like a teenager. We'll have that and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6:30 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 55 degrees and cloudy with scattered showers.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to 10 destinations in India. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. For more than 30 years, one man has been behind the scenes at Seattle Opera. Spate Jenkins took the job after a career as a writer and speaker. It was his first position as an arts administrator. By all measures, Jenkins' tenure has been a huge success. About 2 years ago or so, Jenkins announced that he wanted to retire in the summer of 2014 at the end of Seattle Opera's 50th anniversary season. So the company launched an international search to replace him. And yesterday, Seattle Opera announced the man who has the very daunting task of filling Spate Jenkins' shoes. Aidan Lang is currently General Director of New Zealand Opera. Before that, he worked as Artistic Director for opera companies in Europe. He's also an active opera director himself. I asked Aidan Lang about his first exposure to opera. He told me he was just 12 years old.
I was very lucky. I lived in London. I lived just on the outskirts of London, where we have a very cultural family. We had classical music playing all the time. I was at a school which did music, especially singing, literally at a professional level. So I got to see opera when I was 12. I went all the time. I had a very balanced upbringing. I'd go off to soccer in the afternoon and Covent Garden in the evening, and I saw nothing wrong with that at all.
Well, I do know that Marriage of Figaro was your first professional production, right?
No, actually, the first thing I saw was Magic Flute. The first thing I saw at Covent Garden was Figaro.
Okay.
But I saw a lot of repertoire during those years. And I was also very fortunate, I think, when I was a student. I studied in Birmingham, which was one of the main touring dates of the Welsh National Opera, who at that time were introducing to the UK a different style of opera as theatre, if you like.
What does that mean?
What it means is that I think until the mid-70s, opera was given in a fairly straightforward narrative way, with, you know, probably a primacy to the singing side, that, yes, opera singers acted, but it was, if not half-hearted, it wasn't with a level of compelling commitment we expect today. And I think what the style of productions which we saw from the Welsh National Opera showed a different theatricality. It moved it away from naturalism. And I always say opera, the main canon of opera, doesn't exist in the period of naturalism. In fact, naturalism comes in when opera is on the decline. But we, of course, today, we're used to seeing film and TV. Naturalism is our currency for telling theatrical stories. And, you know, what I was seeing is different ways to tell the same story, and in so doing to allow its meaning and its inner expression to come out.
But you studied as to be an instrumentalist, not...
Everyone assumed I was a music student when I was at university, actually.
You weren't?
No, I wasn't. I was actually doing English and drama, but I hung out with music students the entire time. And I thought, until going to university, I probably was going to take a career in music. And so, therefore, when I graduated, it seemed logical to move into opera. It was combining all skills. And I've stayed there ever since, you know, for over 30 years.
So really, you were just right out of university, you got a job and started in opera?
Yeah, that's exactly right, yes. I did a year of galley, year as a stage manager, because I felt I didn't want to kill anybody when, you know, flying heavy scenery on them. It wouldn't have been a wise career move to kick off that way.
Did you start off wanting to be a director?
By the time I'd graduated, yes. I thought that was always my intention. But then again, I was happy not to rush, because I think, especially today, you know, everyone wants their career immediately. And I'm a great believer in the opera company. I worked at Glyndebourne, and I had 6 or 7 fantastic years at Welsh National Opera before I began taking positions as artistic director, and always with companies. Because, you know, I feel it is the collective which makes the great performances. And yes, you can pull together a whole load of random freelancers and you might have a spectacular success, but what a company gives is a sort of tradition of performance, and that's what really attracted me to coming to Seattle. Having spent some time with the company as part of the interview process, I came away saying, you know, this is an amazingly skilled and fantastic and passionate group of people.
Did Seattle approach you, or did you approach Seattle?
The job search comes into the inbox of most general directors in the world. I get 3 or 4 a year, probably, and most of those I either get back and say, look, I think not for me, but, you know, this person might be interesting, or, you know, you haven't got a suggestion. When this one came in, the timing was perfect for my feeling. I probably would need to move on from New Zealand maybe at the end of 14 anyway. My daughter's schooling comes to the end. We were thinking she would probably go to university in Europe. And we'd sort of set that as a departure date. So the timing was perfect. But also, I have to say, this job doesn't come up often.
Not in 30-some years.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a company with a profile internationally probably far wider than the people in the company realize. And it's often the case that you're better known outside than you are within. So when this one came in, I thought, ooh, this is one I, you know, would be very, very interested in.
You are, I'm not sure fill the shoes is the right term, but you are about to follow somebody who's been in this job for more than half the time that the company has existed, and a man that I personally have called the P.T. Barnum of opera. He's larger than life, so how does one replace that person?
Look, I think the great thing is, I mean, Spate, as you say, he is an extraordinary and important figure in world opera. But what he's done, he's set a path for the company which is absolutely right. And the responsible and sensible thing to do is to just to take up that mantle. Yes, of course, it will in time go in the direction it goes. But it's not about saying, you know, out with the old, in with the new. It's not that at all. Spate and I have already begun a really fruitful relationship. We're in constant contact with each other, and I'm going for dinner with him tonight.
Did you know him well before you came?
No, I didn't know him well. My wife is a very, very good friend of Jane Eaglen. They were bosom buddies at college, and we even came to Seattle for her wedding all those years ago. And I met Spate then at the wedding. My path had tended to be in Europe, but of course everyone knows of him.
In Europe until you went across the world to New Zealand Opera, and I'm kind of curious. Well, first of all, I'm curious about the company because I get the sense reading about it that in your tenure, 7 years, I believe, it has gone from one hub to across the country. So what is that company and what kind of work do you present?
The great thing about the New Zealanders are they have a kind of free spirit. They're very unjudgmental. And I took the job because I wanted to move from being just an artistic director into a general director position. The job came up. I was approached for it. And I thought, yes, it's a long way to travel, of course. But I felt there was a company where the pieces were there. They weren't necessarily all where I felt they ought to have been. And it's been a fantastic journey with, again, a fantastic team of people. But to move opera on and find a style which is very much ours. I mean, I think we're quite kind of out there. And yet our audiences have come along for the journey, and that's what's been so fascinating. One of my favourite things which used to happen is people would say to me, you know, I thought I was a traditionalist, but I really enjoyed that, you know, contemporary production we had done. And I said that's because it was done with integrity and sincerity and truthfulness to the heart of a piece. And, you know, it's very easy to pigeonhole audience members and put them in little brackets. What I find is that if a work does have that integrity and is presented clearly, and that's the difficult one, of course, if the ideas are presented cogently and there's a cohesive argument underpinning them, then actually people will go and have a new experience and feel opera doesn't have to be always done the way they've seen it in the past.
Well, let's talk a little bit about opera, because you talked about the 70s being that time where the way directors and performers approached opera is a little bit different. And I have talked with Spate over the years often, but when I describe opera, I talk about it as sort of the uber theatrical performance. It has three, at least, elements more than any single other. It might have dance, it might have drama, it will have music. So what now in 2013 is opera? How do you describe it to somebody in New Zealand? How did you describe it to someone who thought they would never even go?
Well, I think what the shift in the 70s and 80s did was allow a new form of theatricality to come in. It allowed design, for example, to take a more interpretative stance on a work. And what happens is pieces are very frequently liberated by being given... it's not about a new look, it's about getting to the heart of what the pieces really are about. So I think, you know, opera is in a state of constant transition, and so it should be. I suppose, you know, the best parallel is to think of it, if you look at the way art or indeed the tonality of music shifted, what we call modernism happened back in the 20s or slightly earlier in the visual arts. That's a move away from a representational См visual style or in terms of music away from conventional Western tonality. And I think what's happened in the staging side, we've kind of embraced 70 years later, or whatever, 50 years later, the idea of presentation has taken the same movement that music and art did earlier on. And as always, the essence is about getting to the kernel of the particular piece and presenting it so it resonates with its audience members. And each piece, the big mistake some companies make, or some directors make, is assuming that every piece can go in the same mold, and that's not true. I always say my work as a stage director was quite hard to define, because I would use 6 or 7 different designers, depending on what I felt the piece needed. But as an artistic director, which is sort of the same but one remove away, I do the same thing. So I don't choose the same people all the time. Certain works don't need much interpretive level. Other pieces need a lot and will become much better pieces for that. So the art as an artistic director is always to pick the right person for the right piece.
We're about to present the Ring Cycle. There have been a few different productions. You have directed a Ring as well.
Look, the Ring, of course, is an open book when you start to direct it. And I confronted that, you know, when I had the appointment. Where do you start? Where you start is finding the right language. And I think the visual language is very important for the Ring Cycle, because that is the way in to the piece for your audience members. And of course, like any work, it will reveal, any mythical, you know, mythologically based work, it will reveal itself in many ways. There is no right or wrong. In fact, what I did in our cycle in Brazil, we changed the style throughout it. It was almost like the development of man. So we started with quite abstract for the world of gods and Nibelungs and Rhine Maidens. But then when the humans came in, it was almost like a history lesson from primitivism to a kind of industrial revolution to a sort of modern experimental laboratory. So we took that a journey towards a style for the audience they could understand, you know, who these human beings were.
You are coming to a place that has a big reputation for its Wagner every summer. Is there something, I mean, you mentioned Mozart was the first thing that you saw in professional production. Does that mean that you hold that in a particular place in your heart? Is there something that you really love?
Well, Wagner was one of the great calling cards. I love Wagner, and I also love early music. So there's two complete ends of the spectrum. And I think what delights me about opera is its range. A great development we've had in recent years are explorations into wider ranges of repertoire. In fact, as a director, I've done some really unusual pieces. You know, I did the British premiere of an opera by Frederick Delius. It was written, we premiered it 105 years after it was written. It was only once I was staging it, I thought, I understand now why it hasn't been performed for 105 years. Why didn't I ask?
Will you be able to direct here?
It's not why I've come here, in all honesty. You know, I've had a long directing career, but I really, you know, since 1990, I've also been artistic director of companies and festivals. And I love putting together a production which I haven't directed and seeing it work. It's a real joy and knowing you're serving the piece, you're serving the audience.
Now, you mentioned that you took the job in New Zealand to go from artistic director to general director, which is also the position here in Seattle. And I think opera companies are the only arts organizations that have that title. Usually it's managing director, artistic director. So how is a general director different from an artistic director?
Well, it's sort of combining both responsibilities in one person, really. You need a split personality. Sure. I want to do that. Can I afford it? It's the sort of debate you have with yourself. I think it's vital that a general director is more than just a managing director, because any arts organization has to be led by a vision for its art form, combined with the sense of how we're going to bring that up to the stage. And if it is in the hands of a managing director, the danger is the balance goes the other way and the pragmatism becomes the driving force. You know, the arts are about connecting the piece through the vision of the company to its public.
This is the last of the three or four big arts organizations that has changed artistic leadership in Seattle. Peter Bowl, a little younger than you are, I believe, directing the ballet. Ludovic Morlot has just come to the symphony, a lot younger than everybody. I think he's in his mid-30s. But it's a time, a shift for the cultural community in general. So when you step back and look at your position community-wide outside of the opera, what do you imagine it to be?
Well, you know, you mentioned the community, and that's, I think, a hallmark of an arts organization, maybe as recently as the 21st century. And again, I was really impressed with the community and education work which Seattle do, because I believe, and I wish I could do the same in New Zealand, I just don't have the budget to do it. You know, I believe very, very strongly that today our performances and our experiences of the audience go beyond just what happens in McCaw Hall. And that's what we, you know, it's not peripheral, it's actually core business for us. Because it may be that 0.1% of the young people who engage with an education project become committed opera goers. It's almost not the point. The point is that what opera is telling stories through the extraordinary expressive power of singing, which has an almost primal quality for us. And what has really impressed me with the work which the community and education department are doing is understanding that core issue. It's about storytelling, and then it moves from that into the way it's delivered. And through doing it yourself, but through participation, you're going to have a better understanding of what this art form is about. It was a huge part of attraction for this job for me.
Larger role for you in the civic life of the city?
Yeah, absolutely. But I enjoy that. I've always enjoyed that. I mean, in a sense, in New Zealand, I have three cities to deal with, which is, I enjoy that enormously. And we're building up the third city with Christchurch, and we have Dunedin coming on board as well. So.
Well, here you'll get to stay in one space.
I think it'll make life a lot easier. My air miles go down.
So lastly, you will come and spend several months in transition with Spate in the office. I'm assuming they give you your own office, because I'm having a hard time imagining two of you in one room. But and then when do you imagine, you know, you become, I am now Aidan Ling, general director, and, you know, I take the spear in hand and go forth?
Well, the date is 1st of September 2014. The transition, when it was proposed to me, I thought this is actually a brilliant idea, because one of the things we want to do is enter into collaboration with a number of other companies around the States. That takes time. That takes a bit of journeying. You know, I need to get myself up to speed with who the latest current American singers are. I want to glean as much from Spate, not only in those 6 months, but believe you me, we will be having dinner together for many, 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 many years afterwards. You never stop learning in this business, and to have some of that unbelievable wealth of knowledge is a resource I'd be very foolish to ignore. I wouldn't want to ignore, because he's such good company.
That's Aidan Ling. He's just been named to be the man who becomes Seattle Opera's general director in September 2014. He will fill the shoes of longtime opera leader Spate Jenkins, as if anybody could do that, Bernard.
Well, we wish him the best of luck. It's 10 a.m. Today, a Washington state man's sentencing was reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court. KUOW's Lisa Brooks has that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Service.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.